יצחק ומפון יעקב בית דלי בפולק ישראל פון אלם בייזן אין דיינם לוי אז דלי בשבס קוידש גייט אבק ונאז דבחן דחוידש ומדיור זול עוסוק ומצומונה של אימור צמונה שכח רעמים, צועב אסחברים, צודבי כוסה בוי ריבור וחרור. מאמין צוזי, משלוי שעשר יקורים שלו, ובגאו לו קרוי ובימי רבי ימינו, ובזכי עשה מייסים, ומנבו עשמוי שרבינו, show a line ribay nay shelaylam du bist doch a nay selayef koyach gib deine liebe die schikinde lach koyach dich zu leib und no dich zu dinen und weiter kann andern khalileni Unas di vach und der Heide schon der Jahr Soll uns zu kommen, zu gesund und zu Masel und zu Brache, was loch Und zu Bonnei, Chaye, Yariche Und mehr Säune, Reviche Vesiyat, Od Ishmael כל ישראל ונועם הרומם.
Welcome to Headlines. This is David Lichtenstein. Tonight we're going to have a really interesting discussion. So many of us were overjoyed to see what we considered really an act of rishis, an act of injustice, with the commutation of the prison sentence, the 27-year prison sentence that was given to Shalom Mordechai Rabashkin, a father of 10, 27 years when you had Michael Peppel, he stole $18 million loss. He was initially given 7 days in jail. And then it was upon appeal, it was increased to 2 years in jail. You have the fellow from SAC, Martoma, was given 9 years on a $276 million theft. So, look, the fact that a great injustice was done here was without a doubt. And we were all overjoyed to see the father back with his children. We said 8 years was more than enough. But here's the question. If you go to like sites like Yeshiva World, etc., you see comments like, this is an extension of what happened to Yosef HaTzadik, to the Marami Rutenberg, the Balatanya, the Ruzhina, the Skelena, and Shalom Rabashkin's freedom from prison. Which is why in many circles I saw many yeshivas, he's going there and they're making parties, he's giving out chamashim and candies, etc. And we're going to have two Rabbanim today who are discussing whether all this victory lap or whether this deification, is it really appropriate? And we're going to have a discussion about that. We're going to have on Rabbi Bechafer and Rabbi Horowitz. And on the other side of it, we will have his lawyer, Gary Apfel, really an exceptional story. 4.5 years he did this pro bono, imagine. You know, the Rabashkins had raised, you know, Klal Yisrael, Lakewood, Satma, Chabad had raised over $10 or $15 million for him, which went to a number of attorneys who did absolutely, it seems, nothing. And the Yeshua came from somebody, or well, maybe they did, so I shouldn't, I'm going to be criticized for that. But here's a Yid, Gary Apfel, who spent 4.5 years pro bono. You talk about somebody who found his view, his story, his mission. That should be a really fascinating discussion. We're also going to have on a big Rav from Eretz Yisrael discussing about Birchas HaGoymel. What do you make? Do you make a Birchas HaGoymel when you leave prison? And you're going to find that it's quite complicated. It's not nearly what you thought. We're going to go into discussion. And since we're talking about Birchas HaGoymel, we're also going to be speaking to Rabbi Sefer. he's was on the Dayan on Rosh Weiss's Besdin. He's a member of a very prominent Besdin Eretz Yisrael. He's a writer, etc. A prominent Poisek in Eretz Yisrael. He's going to be speaking about Birchas HaGoymel together with Rabbi Langer. So somebody who leaves prison, make a Birchas HaGoymel. And we'll go from there. Do women make Birchas HaGoymel? Is it appropriate today to make a Birchas HaGoymel after flying? I mean, two people, they take their family, they go to a hotel in Eretz Yisrael for the, they travel, they're eating first class or business class or economy, and they're eating, you know, their food and they're staying in a hotel, and you say, this is dangerous? I mean, really, would you take your family there? So we'll be speaking about Birchas HaGoymel. So this is really should be a fascinating program. I'm sure we'll get a lot of comments again. We post all the comments, the people who say the, really, whose strongest disagreement, those, we put them all up. I believe that, you know, the Torah believes in discussion and debate. There was always machlokes bein chachamim. From the beginning of the Mishnah till today, there's only one perek in entire Mishnayos that doesn't have a machlokes, and that's Eizeh Mekayimin Shel Zvachim. And, you know, the Balei Machshava say when they talk about the Klal Yisrael was always considered the Zvachim. When it came to Eizeh Mekayimin Shel Zvachim, over there was no machlokes to kill Jews. But otherwise, in everything, so we believe in discussion, and we will certainly have a very passionate discussion tonight. Before we start, I would like to say a little vart. You know, this parsha, last parsha, we have the Matah Moshe, Asara Makis, the Matah Moshe. The Matah Moshe, the Gemara says, was Nivra Yemesh, Shishi Bein Hashmashes. It was one of the things, was something magical. It was created by Hashem Bein Hashmashes. What's so magical about the Matah of Moshe? So here's something interesting. Five times, Kaviyachol tries to get Moshe to go, step up, be the agent to redeem Klal Yisrael. And what does Moshe say? Mi anechi, who am I? Ben agarnished, right? He was in a vardika. Mi anechi ki elech. The next time Hashem tries again, he tells him, so Moshe responds, hey, lo yaminu li. Nobody's going to trust me, believe in me. Lo yishmu b'kayli. The Rabbi Shalom tries again. Ani kvad, he's a kvad peh, kvad lushin, arals fasaim. Three reasons. I'm very difficult to understand intellectually. That's kvad peh. Kvad lushin and my safa, the way my articulation is difficult. And kvad lushin, and I actually have a physical handicap. Three reasons. And he says, shlach, the Kaviyahu comes again. Shlach, nabi atishlach, send it. Moshe is anav mikaladim. He doesn't think he could do it. He doesn't think he's worthy. He doesn't think he's the appropriate messenger. So Rabbi Shalom says to him, Mazeh biyadcha. I mean, what Mazeh biyadcha? We both knew, everybody knew what he had in his hands. He says, Mateh. He says, Hashlichehu Arza. What's the question and what's the answer? Yes, he had a stick in his hand, just a stick. But he said, Mazeh biyadcha. Think of it. What is a shepherd? What is his staff? Yes, it's to walk. It could be to climb. But it could also be you could draw a picture with it on the ground, a direction. You could guide a sheep that's straying, you tap him. It could be a weapon. He thought he only had a matzah in his hand. No, he had a great power. He said, Ashlichei Warza became a monster. It's powerful, the matzah you have in your hand. The Rabbeinu Shalom was telling Moshe, you think you're powerless. You have a whole nation of slaves. You yourself, you're an anav, you don't know if you can, you can't. Mazeh biyadcha, what do you have? Unleash that power that you have in you. Awaken that power. And that matzah becomes the symbol of Yetzias Mitzrayim. How many of us don't know what power? We don't know our story. You know, what's your story? This Gary Apfel, he was a lawyer at Pepper Hamilton. He discovered a story. He found somebody who was 27. He says, that's my story. I'm giving up my job for that story. He found the mission, right? Now, here's something interesting. You know, I heard this Torah from Yosef Yitzchak, the guy. He said like this. I heard the Vard is like this. It says, you're not allowed to count Jews. But if you give a chatzi, machtes hashekel, you could count the Jews. If you could give a tler, like shoulders, you could count the Jews. What is it? So it's a joke. Don't count the Jew. Count the money he gave to tzedakah. Here's a very passive, powerful verse. If you count Jews, you're going to be very disappointed. There's really not a lot of Jews in the world. There's 0.2%. It's a tiny fraction. There are more Muslims born every 2 months than there are Jews in the world. the Jews are so small. It's like we're Bottle, but I mean, what are we? We're two out of a thousand. Bottle Meshishim 10 times over, 50, right? So if you count Jews, you're going to be very disappointed. But if you look at Jews' contribution, Zeyitnu, it's astonishing. In chemistry, 20%, 30% of the U.S. total prize winners in chemistry, these are Nobel Prize, 33% of the U.S. total for literature, economics, 39% of the world's total of economics, 51 in medicine, 27% of the world's total by 2.02% of the world's population. That means we contribute 100 times, or in some of these cases, it's 200 times in whichamacallit, in economics, it's almost 200 times our weight, right? It's like cayenne pepper. You don't want to put a lot of it into a soup, trust me, or salt or anything, right? And it's interesting. If you look at the world, the descent of Spain, when the golden era of Spain was when the Jews were there. When they evicted the Jews, they grabbed their money, they killed the metaphorical chicken, they killed the goose that laid the golden egg. Spain from 1500 is descended, 1550, till today. What do they do? It's a place where you could get, they supply tomatoes for parts of southern Europe. What has come out of Spain? Nothing. Zilcho. From the great Spanish Armada, right? If you look, where did the Jews migrate to? Italy and Germany. Both became huge world powers. What happened when Germany started killing and expelling the Jews? The head scientist, Hitler, met the great mathematician who was leading the German University of Berlin. He said, "What's it like? What's math like in your university?" And he said to him, "There is no more math in our university. All the Jews have left." Right? So what has happened? Where the Jews have gone, innovation has followed, creativity, cures for diseases, economic prosperity, and when they left, it all left with them, the human capital. And where did it end up today? It ended up in the United States. And look at the flourishing of the United States the last 100 years since they've opened the doors to let the Jews in. So, Zeyitnu Kalev Ralapikudim, if you look at a Jew at his size, well, not very big, with not a lot of us, if you look at the contribution, so what's the biggest mistake a person could make? Not recognizing the story that each one of us has, especially if you're a co-religionist, the power that we have. Look at history. It speaks for itself, right? So what does Hashem ask Moshe? Maze biyotcha. You know how you're going to redeem Klal Yisrael? Yeah, you think it's a nation of slaves. You think you're a miyanoichi, shlachta biyatishtach, you're a kvatpeh, kvatloshin. Maze biyotcha. What's the power you have? Don't look at your size. Don't look at your numbers. Look at how much you can influence the world. So what's the message to us? It says, b'chol dor v'dor. Everybody's supposed to see themselves as they left Mitzrayim. Well, you know where the beginning of Geula starts with? You know where the beginning of our Mitzrayim, getting out of our problems? What could our problems be? They could be economical. They could be shidduch. They could be molestation. They could be relationship. You know where it all starts with? Hashem asks every one of us every year before, in these parshas, Mazeh biyadcha, did you spend time realizing your story? And we've had on this program so many, from like Gary Apfel this week to people like Sandra Gerber, who just stopped the terrorists, the PLO, Hamas, from getting money. One person changed. We've had so many people who next week, the people who have the genetic testing. There's so many who do. 100 years ago, how many yeshivas were there in this country? Look around now. There's hundreds of choice. Mazeh biyadcha. We could fix whatever the problem. Problem is, you know what the beginning it is? Mazeh biyadcha. What's the power you have in your hand? So let's go to our wonderful line and our guest. We're going to start off with Birchas Hagaimel. We have on the phone with us from Yerushalayim, Rav Yeshua Pfeffer. He's a Rav in Ramot. He's also formerly a Dayan. He was formerly on the Bezdin of Rav Asher Weiss. Now he's on a private Bezdin. And he is he writes for the Institute of Dayanim in Yerushalayim. He is one of their writers. Welcome, Rabbi Pfeffer.
Thank you very much. Thank you. That's a pleasure to be on.
So, Rabbi Feber, I know you've written about Birchas HaGomel, so I'd like to ask you a few questions. For starters, the Shulchan Aruch says that, the Gemara says, Arbat Shricham Lahai, there's one as a Yaitzami Asiri under Yubarazel, somebody who left prison, right? So the question is, if somebody left prison, does it have to be for Dine Nefashos? Does it have to be that his life is actually at risk? He's a Bisakana? Or is somebody who's in prison for Dine Mamanis, can he also make a Birchas HaGaimel? And I understand that the Magen Avraham opines it needs Dine Nefashos, the Bir Halacha and Mishneh Berurah seems to name on that way. What is the consensus about Paiskim? Give us a little color.
All right, so it is a bit of an involved question. I'll try to give you the color as you mentioned. So yes, like you said, the basic ruling of the Gemara, the Shulchan Aruch, is that somebody who's in prison and comes out of prison makes a Berachas HaGoimel. However, the basic assumption of the Gemara, as Rashi says, and as the poets can assume, is that there's an element of sakana, there's an element of danger involved in being imprisoned. And therefore, because you are relieved of that danger, you escape from that danger unharmed, so you make a Berachas HaGoimel. So that's what really, that's the impulse, so that's the understanding behind the Magen Avraham, who says that somebody who is only Machmas Nefashos, which the Bi'ur Halacha understands to mean that there's no actual danger in his imprisonment, meaning the authorities want him for money, or either because of a monetary offense or for his money. There's different, slightly different ways of understanding this. But one way or the other, if he's not in actual physical danger, then he wouldn't make a Birchas HaGoimel. But that isn't quite the end of the story, because there are a few other factors to need to be put into the equation, and I'll be happy to mention them. So first of all, the Mishneh Berurah, the Bi'ur Halacha, mentions that this could be contingent on a much broader discussion, which is basically a discussion between Poskei Sfarad and Poskei Ashkenaz. It's already brought in the Torah and in the Shulchan Aruch. Now, the custom of Yotzei Sfarad is to be more to be more broad, to have broader strokes in what enables or what is appropriate to make a Birchas HaGoimel over, even if there's only a slight danger, even if there's only a less of a possibility for a danger of life. So the custom of Sfarad is still to make a Birchas HaGoimel. That's why Sfarad make a Birchas HaGoimel over journeys that Ashkenazim don't, from city to city. The Mishneh Berurah speaks about people who go on a boat, on a river, not on the actual sea. Somebody who is sick, the Rambam Paschim, someone who is sick, even if it's not a dangerously ill disease, it's only a sickness that you're bedridden for a few days, still you'll make a Berachas HaGoimel. And Mishneh Berurah says that the same thing could apply over here.
Okay, interruption, Rabbi Feber. I just want to interrupt because you're referring to the Mechaba and Reishu Tes Zion. I have a question for you. So do the Sfaradim, if somebody gets the flu and they go to bed, they really make a Birchas HaGomel? Is that what, I'm an Ashkenazi, so I daven mostly in Ashkenazi shuls. Is that really so? You have the flu, you come back, you make a Birchas HaGomel, B'Shem HaMalchus. Is that the minik?
Well, actually, yes. It doesn't have. You wouldn't make a Birchas HaGomel on a mild illness, something that you have to go to bed for a couple of days or. But if somebody is significantly ill,
Rabbi Feffer, if you would make from driving from city to city, which means if you drive from Lakewood to Lawrence, you make a Birchas HaGomel, why wouldn't you make a Birchas HaGomel on the flu?
Well, that's really a nuanced question for the Minhag Sfarad. The question is really, how far do you take this Birchas HaGomel that involves some element of danger? Because the flu, you can have complications from flu. They're pretty rare. And it's only if it's a serious flu, meaning you're in bed for a week, then perhaps you can start getting into issues of, well, because there's potential complications, you're bedridden. But the Poskei Sfarad also agree that for an illness which is, you take a little bit of antibiotics and you get over it, you wouldn't make a Berachat HaGoymel. And I think the basic distinction will be that still, Berachat HaGoymel, even according to the Mechaber, which is the Poskei Sfarad, still requires something extraordinary. You don't
so
make
Rabbi Pfeffer, when the Sfaradim and Eretz Yisrael drive from Yerushalayim to Bnei Brak, they make a Berachat HaGoymel?
So most of them don't. Even the Rabbi Vada Yosef actually does say that it would be appropriate to make a Berachat HaGoymel, even over such a car journey from city to city, which is the opinion of the Mechaber. But the generally accepted minig, even among Sfaradim, is that for regular everyday journeys, you know, people drive every day to work from Yerushalayim to Bnei Brak. This is an everyday occurrence. It's like going from Brooklyn to Manhattan.
From Haifa to Yerushalayim, they make a Berachat HaGoymel?
No, from Tzfat to Eilat, a significant journey. A journey. which is not an everyday journey. Anyway,
okay.
So that also has implications for our prison case, because it's true that today prisons aren't directly dangerous. However, because you could come into contact with certain unseemly prisoners who might involve some element of danger, and because prison in and of itself can be a dangerous place, and if you fall out of line or do things out of order. So perhaps, according to the Poskei Sfarad, it's easier. It's easier to make HaGoymel on prison sentences, even today, according to Poskei Sfarad. But let's leave the Poskei Sfarad aside. As you said, you daven many with Ashkenazim. And I think even from the Ashkenazim perspective, which takes a more stringent line, a more narrow line in terms of where it's appropriate to make HaGoymel, there's still a couple of considerations. You see, in the Rishonim, there are a number of poskim, a number of Rishonim and later poskim, who do mention that even machmas mamoin, even for imprisonment that doesn't seem to have a direct danger, danger of death, danger of capital punishment, still you would make a Berachat HaGoymel. And there's two actual different, different lines of thought among the Rishonim, if you medayik them. Of why this is so. So the Rabbeinu Yonah, which is brought by some of the folks, Rabbeinu Yonah says that even in somebody machmas mamoin, he says there's still some element of sakana. He's explaining the order that the Gemara says them in, and he says the Beis HaSoron comes last, even in the pasuk it's not. But he says because ein sakana se kol kach, it's not such a danger. And he's speaking about Chavos Bavrim Mamoin, somebody who's in prison because of monetary issues. And he says it's a lesser level of sakana. So according to Rabbeinu Yonah, it seems that you would still make a HaGoymel for not like the Magen Avraham, but not because of a different, not because of a completely different line of reasoning, but just because there's still some element of danger. So then you would say, well, perhaps today, in our prisons, there just isn't any element of danger. And, nobody's going to be put to death if you're there for some monetary offense. But the Rimagash is something else. The Rimagash, who's also brought he's brought in the Sharit Shiva, actually, in Reish Yates, of course. So the Rimagash says that even somebody who is Machmas Mamoin, even for a monetary offense, you would still make a HaGoymel, and this is interesting. He says, because while he's in prison, he says, the person wasn't in control of his own self. He was imprisoned. Imprisoned meaning he lost all semblance of freedom, right? He didn't have any autonomy, right? And he says, now he came out of that situation, and now he is in control of himself, and that itself is sufficient, according to the Rimagash, to make the HaGoymel. That's a chiddush, because this isn't a straight sakana, but the Rimagash says that itself is sufficient for the Beis HaAsurim, and that presents a new kind of horizon, a new option for the Berachat HaGoymel on somebody who comes out of prison. It's interesting, the Shulchan Aruch Rav, when he says this machmas mamoin thing, as other poskim, the Aruch HaShulchan, by the way, says there's no difference. Machlas mama and machlas nefasha. You make a hagoy milk. He puts it all together.
Well, but respectfully, like, Rabbi Pfeffer, respectfully, the I think it's the Machtus HaShekel.
Yes.
On the Magen Avraham, he says, you know, didn't the Magen Avraham see Rabbeinu Yaina?
Yeah. So the Machtus HaShekel actually resolves.
Right.
He resolves the Magen Avraham with Rabbeinu Yaina.
He says that, you know, they used to catch Jews, Machmas Mammon, and it was an excuse to torture them to death. And you see a similar concept, let's say, in Shin Pei Ches and Chayshu Mishpat. You see that a Meiser Machmas Mammon is considered a Meiser Machmas Tafashis. He says, and it's
right,
the Lashon Rishonim.
To another, right.
Yeah, he says they catch a Jew, they want his money, and they figure out a way how to put him to death to get his money. So I think certainly we've seen enough in our history where money was an excuse to lead to life.
Right.
So if you go down that
route, are you insinuating that that would be true today in the U.S.?
I don't think it would be. Or? I don't think that would be true in a federal. I don't think they're trying to put people in prison to take their money away. It's not how the government works. So,
right. That's the way Machtus HaShekel understands.
Learns. Yeah.
That it's not the pshat that they're doing it because of a monetary offense, but rather they're doing it to get your money.
To get
that's
your money.
His kind
yeah,
of innate
and understanding. And therefore they will kill you, and they will ultimately, it could lead
right,
to
and he resolves, death. Right, and that's how he resolves the Magen Avraham with the Rabbeinu Yonah. It's an interesting shot that he has.
But you know, the Rimigash that you quote, I have seen, I forgot in which of the Paiskim, I saw once, he said that
right.
The concept
Shavuot
of,
brings it.
Yeah, that the concept of Moshel Banafsha, which is a strange concept, where does it say, like you quoted before, the Gemara says, Abad Shri Chalahidis, Rashi says over the Kesha Yotzin Min HaSakana, like where is, so what does it have to do with Moshel Banafsha? And I have seen that the explanation of the Rimigash, and you tell me whether you think this is a stretch or not, is that when somebody is not Moshel Banafsha, so it means that they could get depressed, and depression itself could be very dangerous. Because when somebody loses their freedom, it leads to marashchayra. Marashchayra, you see it already in the Paiskim, the Gemara Brachas, they could have a din of pikuach nefesh if somebody gets, you know, adequately depressed. And if that's the case, you know, when somebody serves a lengthy sentence, it would certainly be where there's a concept of marashchayra nefesh and where marashchayra, et cetera, certainly has to play a role where you say it would have a din of pikuach nefesh. What do you think about that way to read the Rimigash?
Hey, it would be interesting. The thing with your way of reading the Rimigash is that opens up some very broad halachic ramifications, because what you're saying is that the concern of imprisonment is in fact depression of some sort, and then depression itself is a concern for death eventually, meaning you're making a second step removed, and then you would say, well, if somebody imprisoned makes a hagoymer because of the concern for depression, then kal vachoymer, somebody who is actually depressed, would make a hagoymer, right? So you would have a very interesting halachic nafkamina here, for example, for somebody who is depressed. And if you're saying that somebody who is depressed and then becomes healed, or his depression is healed and he's no longer depressed, he would make a hagoymer. So the same would be true of other kind of conditions. How about some kind of an eating disorder, but, you know, that would also be a ground for a hagoymel. So I think it's an interesting line of thought. I think it's innovative. I would point out that Shulchan Aruch HaRav, interestingly enough, when he says that you make a hagoymel even on machmas mamoin, which is what he rules, he says, but only if the prisoner is put in chains, in azikim, he says, azikim, in chain. Meaning, which is very—it seems very strange. You know, what has change got to do with it?
He's getting it from the pasuk. That's where he's getting it from.
Well, that
asirei anu yubar asirei anu yubarzel. So the pasuk
that's
in chain.
That's true. Meaning, it's in the pasuk, but it's not in the halachic. You know, the gemara derives from the pasuk that somebody in Beis HaSurim makes a hagoymel. Now, clearly, somebody who's in Beis HaSurim, Machmas Nefashos, would make a Hagoymel even without being in Azikim. That's clear also from the Shulchan Aruch HaRav. But he says, but if it's Machmas Mamoim, then with a Tziruf, if he's also in Azikim, then he would make a Hagoymel, which is a strange Tziruf, you know. either Machmas Mammon is sufficient for the Hagomel or not. But perhaps with the Rimagash, you can have some ta'am, you can have some, make sense of this, you can have some understanding of this, because, you know, the question is your freedom really completely being repressed? Have you lost all semblance? You know, you don't have any control over your physical motions. You've lost all control over yourself. And I think that's the most simple understanding of the Rimagash. You know, putting in the depression it's like an ukimta kind of, which is possible.
Yeah, I'm trying to resolve is the Lashon HaRishonim in Haroya is that it's always Kishayotze min HaSakana. Taisa says, we list the orders HaMesukah and Yoser. So the Moshe Benafshe does not rise to the level of Sakana. So where does he get this do element, this Chiddush?
Well, first of all, the Gemara itself doesn't say Sakana, right? The Gemara says that there are Barashat Tzrichim Lehoidis, it's true that Rashi, and you know, it's not just Rashi, it's true that the Rishonim in general.
Taisa says the same.
Rashi and the other Rishonim, meaning even the Rishoni Sarat, for instance, when they speak about journeying from city to city, then they're very careful to point out, because there's a Yerushalmi that says, Kol HaDrachim are b'cheskas Sakana. You know, any kind of a journey has some element of danger. So it's true that Sakana is a basic, very basic theme in the Sugya. But I think the simple understanding of the Rimagash is that losing your basic liberty, losing your most fundamental freedom, right? Think about the Shulchan Aruch HaRav, who speaks about being in chains, right? A prisoner who is in chains. He's lost everything. He doesn't have, you know, the Les Miserables, you know, the prisoner who's lost everything. So a prisoner like that is it's true he's not necessarily in danger of imminent death, but he's lost his life for all intents and purposes. Meaning, it's true that he's not physically dead, but like the Gemara says, that Ani Choshev Kemes, so this is much, much, much worse than an Ani. He's lost everything. He doesn't have a life. It's an extension. It's a stretch. But it's a stretch which, you know, we can strongly identify with. Although you're right, this isn't the strict Sakana that the other Rishonim seem to be working with.
How would you, bottom line, what would you say? Somebody who's usher today, Machmas Mammon, in a U.S. jail, what would you paskin?
Well, that's a good question. Let me say the following. You know, in general, we're quite careful with Safek Brachas Lahatel, you know, when there's a Safek, we're worried about Brachas Lahatel, and therefore, in many instances, even in Birchas HaGoyma, we find Poskim saying Safek Brachas Lahatel, even, you know, many Poskim say this, even about flights, that Safek Brachas, and so on. But this is a little bit like the slippery slope idea, that slopes have two sides to them. And on the one side, you have the Safek Brachas, but on the other side, you have this idea of making brachos. You know, making brachos brings in HaKadosh Baruch Hu into the significant events, the significant things that we do in our lives. Whether it's you know, everyday things like eating, or whether it's special events like when we make Shechiyonu. And I do find it a little bit, you know, a little bit difficult, you know, even after, you know, to prevent somebody who's coming out of prison, who's been there for years, let's say, you know, it's not a 2-day, jail sentence, but it's a real prison sentence for a few years. And then he's coming out. It's such an incredible, significant event. It's difficult to say, perhaps this is a bit too emotional to get into strict halacha, and perhaps you can also make a hatovia meitiv, you know, just because of the joy of being released. So, you know, you can make a bracha anyway. But because we have these poskim, we have the Aruch HaShulchan, we have the Shulchan Aruch HaRav, although he speaks about being in chains, so I don't think we're so much in chains today. It would depend on the hardship, I guess, of the prison sentence, but we have many other acharonim.
I mean, you have the Elio, the great Elio Rabba. I mean, he's the
Elio Rabba, right? We have many acharonim.
Sentence allowed. So let me follow up.
We have many friends who do permit it, so
let me follow this up with a question. You would permit it. The Shulchan Aruch quite famously, or maybe infamously, paskins that somebody else who's very close or feels a tremendous kinship or is also delighted with that person who basically makes the gaimel, the stranger, or rather this friend or this person who has that kinship could also make a gaimel. And he makes a little different. He says, Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu Ham Asher Gmolcha Kol Tov. So in a case where you have a prisoner who has many people who are jubilant and excited and happy about his release, can they make a gaimel as well? And which is the opinion of the Beis Yosef and the Rama, even though there are Paiskim who disagree. But would you say in this case, let them all make a gaimel?
Right. So first of all, interesting question. Second, a couple of things. So first of all, the kind of drive that we have, right, the impetus to allow the person coming out of prison himself to make the Hagoimel, right, and to be lenient with Aruch Shulchan and Eliyahu Rabbah and the other Poskim who are lenient on this, we wouldn't have that so much for everybody else. I mean, we don't have a halachic will, if you want, there's less of a need, as it were, to be making on this for others. But beyond that, the actual application for which traditionally, I'm just saying, how does Klal Yisrael apply this ruling of other people making Hagoimel for somebody very close, somebody that you have a close relationship or kinship with, is very, very limited. You know, we find it in very exceptional cases. For example, husband and wife here and there, we find it that a priest can mention Gmalich, then we would say Kol Tov, Sheh Gmalich Kol Tov, and other very limited applications. You know, it's something which is generally absent from Sefer HaPoskim and also generally absent from everyday custom, from everyday mimic, you know.
Even though the case in the Gemara in Haroa, which I forgot his name, Rav Samson Bagadata from Baghdad, is where basically a friend came up, saw that his friend, who he thought was very ill, got better, and he made the bracha. So I forgot his first name, the Tanner, Yitzchak Bagadata. So you see that it is used for, I mean, it is, you know, for friends, not just for husband and wife. This was a case of friendship.
Meaning we do find a precedent for it. I'm just pointing out that the general
not
custom,
commonly done.
So I would be. But I have another point that I would also add on to that, and that is that we have to be a little bit careful, I would say, about this kinship idea, meaning perhaps we're all very happy that somebody comes out of prison, and I'm assuming you're referring to the Rubashkin, the recent Rubashkin affair. So, you know, everyone's very happy. There's a kind of didon notzach atmosphere. And there's a lot to speak about that also. I don't know if this is germane to the discussion, but in any case, you know, that we have to distinguish between that joy at seeing somebody released from prison and between this very intimate kinship and this, you know, of husband wife or very, very close relationship that would enable the bracha that you're referring to.
What is your opinion about the Didon Natzach? We're going off the halacha for a minute, but I am curious.
Well, do you want to be a bit more specific about the question?
Yeah, I'm sure you mentioned it. You said that there is an attitude of Didon Natzach, and it's worth discussing. So I'm just following that with the question.
Well, I just think, you know, it's. There is something nuanced here, and the nuance is that on the one hand, of course, we're very, very happy that somebody has come out of prison, and I think that's absolutely legitimate to be joyful that somebody's come out of prison. At the same time, you know, one has to be wary of presenting the right message to young people that, you know, and I would have expected, would have hoped that you know, that the message would be broadcast, that we're very happy that somebody's come out of prison. One has to be very careful to avoid the kind of actions that put you into prison in the first place. And, you know, with all the joy of coming out, it would have been far, far, far more joyful and far, far better had he not gone in the first place.
So let me follow up, since I have you, let me follow up with a question that bothers me.
And then, just by the way, before you follow up, there's an interesting question that could be asked also on the Hagoimel perspective. And this is mentioned by some of the poskim. Tzitzi Eliezer speaks about this somewhere. What happens when somebody places himself in danger, meaning he does something wrong and he's put into jail because of something wrong that he did? Do you make Hagoimel, even though it's evidently your fault? You know, you're in prison not because they made something up and put you there on false charges, but they put you there on true charges. So that's also a discussion. That, you know, my opinion.
Well, respectfully, I haven't seen the Tzitzel yet, but respectfully, I would say that it says Arba Tzricha L'Haydeis. Somebody who went down to the ocean. Now, let's say somebody he went into a ship because he was a tourist. He wanted to see the Pantheon.
I agree. I think that's a good lie. I agree with you.
Would you say he doesn't make a Gaimel? Or somebody who crossed the desert to go to his cousin's bar mitzvah. Would you say he doesn't mention Gaimel? Or somebody who's maybe a chayla because they were outside and they caught a cold and they weren't wearing a coat. Is it brought any place in the Paiskim that they don't bring a Gaimel? So I find this concept very... I agree with you.
And that's also what the Tzitzi Eliezer decides, even though he brings from, I think, the Machzik Brach or from some other authority that says not like that. But however, there would be interesting cases, borderline cases. For example, somebody who goes bungee jumping, okay, or something really dangerous, but he does it, you know, because he wants the thrill of the danger, and then he actually survives. Would he make a Hagoimel on that? And then I would probably say no, because if you're actually looking for the danger, it's the danger that you want, and then you're saved from that danger, then I think it stands to reason that you wouldn't make a Hagoimel on that.
I think somebody who attempted suicide, that would be the question. Does he make a gaimel or not? But let me follow this up with a much more relevant question. I noticed something in the news a week ago that 2017 was the safest year ever for air travel, that there were 1.5 billion or so, some very, very large number of you know, passenger flights, and there wasn't a single accident, right? And in general, the accident level for flying is in commercial aircraft, that is very minimal. It's 1 in 16 million, I believe. Juxtapose that with car accidents, where 1.25 million, that's 1.25 million people died in the last year, from car accidents. Now, given that the Gemara, like we said, it says Arba Tzricha L'Haydeis K'sheyotzin Min HaSakana, and you had it's the safest mode of travel that there is. Period. Like I heard one person say, he says by far the most dangerous thing about air travel is the drive to the airport. Right?
Right.
You had over 1 million people die in car accidents, and maybe 1 million different car accidents. We're at zero flights. Hasn't benching Gaimel become a little bit of a comedy? I mean, you have a person, he flies to Eretz Yisrael for a simcha, and they're eating first-class food or second-class food. If there was any element of danger, let's face it, would a person take his whole family together on an airplane? Of course not. It's absurd. And the statistics say it's absurd. So to me, I was actually in shul where somebody made a Birchas HaGaimel, and the guy next to me said very out loud, Baruch Shem Kivayit Malchus Eloylam Vod, like the Ramah in Hilchus Tefillin, right? So are we at a point where we're making, you know, we're talking about, does you need Pikuach Nefesh? By going to jail, the Mishnah Berurah says it has to be Dafka, somebody Machmas Nefashis. By a Chayli, it has to be a Makas Chalal, where the person's life is in danger. And now we have a guy, he's flying to Eretz Yisrael, you know, for a bar mitzvah, to stay at some fancy hotel, or not, and he's making a Gaimel. We're making a Litzanis out of Gaimel, aren't we?
Well, let me make a couple of points on that. First of all, I mean, you're asking on flight, but you could ask the very same question about a cruise, right? About a cruise on a boat.
And I think if the statistics say, and I don't know the statistics, that a cruise was so safe, even though from what I understand, a lot of people get food poisoning, they may have to make a different bracha. But if indeed, you know, it was so safe, etc., then it would be the same question. And
right. Many foods can be quaked. Many foods can be quaked flights. It's also considered Yodei Hayam. Rav Moshe says that's not the case. Rav Moshe says even a flight, even an inland flight, right, a flight from New York to Chicago, it would also make a Hagoyman.
Now, I'm aware of the tshuva of Rav Moshe. However, it's possible.
Right. And by the way, he starts off the tshuva, that tshuva, Rav Moshe starts off by saying that flights have an inherent sakana. That's
right,
but he
also says in the same tshuva, he says, if it would be absolutely not dangerous, he writes that in the tshuva, you would not make a bracha. So I say that given the statistics that you have, most people think car driving isn't dangerous, you had 1.25 million people die by death in cars and zero in planes. Yes, it's over 1 billion and plus flights. So yes, it says that it has reached a level where it's not even a miyut. It's bottle tens of millions. And therefore, based on that, it reached that level that even Rav Moshe says is should not be a bracha, and it becomes a bracha of atala.
Right. So I would make the following point, which is a general point about how halacha works, because this really isn't a question about birchas hagoyimot. It's a question about halacha in general. You know, you could say it's a question on philosophy of halacha or a question of how halacha works. And you can make the same case against making a shechianu on a new fruit, you know, in the U.S. or anywhere in the world, basically. You have, you know, seasonal fruit the whole year round. They import them from goodness knows where, and still we're making shechianu on new fruits, you know, when they come round, even though, you know, most people don't feel any great joy at you know, eating the oranges when they, you know, whatever it is, and still we make those shechianu brachos, and the same idea will apply over here, in that since Chazal derived from Sukkim and it's not an enactment of Chazal, but Chazal was kaveh, right? Chazal said that these are the things that you make the bracha on. So there's a certain, you would say, conservatism, a certain traditionalism about the way halacha works, that you don't say, well, because today things are different, so we're gonna cancel these brachas. Think about, for example, Yeridea, right? Would you say that because stainless steel is not Belair, because our stainless steel is
but
much
respectfully,
more...
respectfully, let me respond to those points, okay? I would say like this, that first of all, if you were a Rav 100 years ago and somebody had strep throat and they came to you, should they make a Birchas Hagaymol? If I were the Rav, and I'm not a Rav, I would say 100%. I know somebody who didn't take antibiotics for strep throat, and they almost died from it, and they needed to have major surgeries too. I don't want to, you know, but person sometimes listens. But my point is, they almost died from that, right? Today, right. If somebody came to you and they said, I had strep throat and I took penicillin, should I make a birchas hagoyim? Well, you would of course say no. So what is a sakana and what isn't a sakana clearly could change. Now, in the case of the stainless steel pots that you're talking about, that you're saying, even though it's, you know, the Poskim do use it as a sniff for heter or Shleim Zalman, etc., you know, it is used by Poskim because there are no blias, Bizman Azeh based on. But over there, the point is, from making the Chumrah, nothing comes, there's nothing wrong. Adarab, we have a minig, there are many minhagim. Today, I think everybody would tell you that there's no danger eating fish and meat together. All the Goyish restaurants have surf and turf. They serve, and they're not dying in droves, right? So what is it? It became a minig Yisrael that's what we do. But here, on the other hand, you have a shayla of making a bracha b'shem malchus, right? So you're taking a chumrah, and because of that chumrah, being nichnas into a suffix, depends according to which paiskim, of a deraisa of mitzi shem levatale, sisa shem ashav, right? Not like the Magen Avraham, but like many other paiskim.
Well, first of all,
so here's a chumrah where there's no damage, here there's a chumrah where there's a real problem because of it.
Right, but you have to remember that according to many paiskim, and this is a question which we don't have to get into now, but the question of whether you make a bracha on the minute, on the argument, and this is clearly minig, right? Making a bracha on the minig,
you're saying
again,
it's like halal. You're saying it would be like halal, where you're making a bracha al minig. I understand,
that's one possibility. But the other thing,
but I think there's a differentiator there. Okay, go ahead.
The other thing, Rav David, is that by contrast with a strep throat, which is something which changes, you know, over the years, and from one century to the next, we've had a revolution in medical science and in everything. And of course, brachas will change accordingly. These four basic categories, right, Yerde Hayam and Asurim and Chulish and Israfi and so on, these basic categories, I think that Chazal derived from Psukim.
Look at the Pasuk. It says, Hey Maro Masay Hashem, Yerde Ambanias, Oisim Lachem Ayim, Hey Maro Masay, they saw the miracles of Hashem that they were saved. Well, nobody who's taking a cruise with Carnival Cruises is going to say, Hey Maro Masay Hashem, and nobody who's taking Elal with their family to stay in a hotel is going to say, Hey Maro Masay Hashem. The very same Pasuk I'm pointing out, right?
Yeah, but it's worth mentioning that the Rav Moshe has a very interesting deher. He has a very interesting line of thought over here in his tshuva. Rather than just going with sakana, which is one possibility, he doesn't do that. He actually goes in a slightly different direction, and he says, what's the fundamental idea of the Hagoyma about a boat? The idea is that without the boat, you're dead, because without a boat, you're drowning in the water. So the boat is saving you. Right, every second you're kind of in danger in a kind of in an inherent way, in an existential way.
Would you make a bracha then if you went over a bridge? Because if the bridge wasn't there, you would die.
No, because the bridge is part of land. The bridge is part of land. The sea, well, you know, that gets into the Gemara there with the Egro is up there. Let's not go there. But I think it's a creative, it's an interesting way of thinking. He says Kal v'chomer about an airplane that, you know, were it not for the airplane, you're in mid-air. You know, you're 10,000 feet up in the air. Were it not for the airplane, you're instantly dead. And so the airplane, as it were, is keeping you alive. And that itself is ground. And it's a creative and interpretive way. He's not addressing your question, of course. He's addressing a slightly different question. But it's an interpretive. It's a creative way of thinking of how, you know, we take the halachas that we have, and you know, because, you know, you can give sociological reasons, you can give, religious reasons, or whichever reasons you want. We'll probably carry on making Berachas HaGomel after going on cruises and so on, because, you know, the daily place can have this responsibility to maintain the halacha and not to change it in drastic ways. So we'll probably carry on doing it. And this is a nice idea of giving it a kind of new interpretation, as it were, which I don't think anybody said this before of Moshe. I don't know anybody, but it gives it a kind of new meaning that could be applicable even today. True, not quite in the same sense as perhaps it was understood previously, but still in a sense that gives us more of a ta'am and more of an understanding of how the bracha can be made in spite of your very, I think, on the point objections in saying. And by the way, there are plenty of people who do make Hagomel on flights, but not quite for your reason. They just say that flights is yep. different from boats. But let's speak about boats, right? Somebody who makes a cruise, who crosses the Atlantic on a boat, which I think is very, very, again, definitely less risky than driving a car. And still, people are going to carry on making Hagomel on that for, you know, the next, I don't know how long.
Well, Rabbi Pfeffer, thank you very much for your time and most interesting Divrei Torah.
Thank you very much. All the very best.
Kol tov, bye-bye.
Kol tov, yishar koach.
We have on the phone with us Rabbi Gavriel Bechafer from Muncie, New York, who's a noted Rebbe, Mechanech, author. Welcome, Rabbi Bechafer.
Thank you very much.
Rabbi Bechafer, tell me, we've had various letters from people who are concerned that the partying, that the, you know, the singers, etc., they're making big asifis, the celebrations for Rabashkin. There are people who are concerned about it. Could you express to our audience what your concern is?
Well, there are a couple of things. First of all, I think everybody should be happy that Shaul Mordechai Bashkin was released. It is a chesed of whoever is responsible for it that it happened. And Shaul HaKadosh Baruch Hu for that. On the other hand...
And additionally, Rabbi Bechafer, and additionally, would you agree that the sentence was way excessive? It was a miscarriage of justice at a pogrom in a way, like a mini pogrom?
The first two, yes. The third thing, no. I would be very careful using the word pogrom. I think that it's misapplied in this case. Yes, certainly was a miscarriage of justice. Obviously, many great lawyers and political figures took that position, and obviously they know what they're talking about. And therefore, it should have certainly been a shorter sentence. But I would never call this a pogrom under any circumstance. And I'm not sure that such language is not inflammatory to a certain extent.
Okay. So what is your concern then?
There are two concerns. The concern is the primarily the issue is garus ba'umos. In other words, we know that this is satma shita because of the sholosh shvuos concerning Eretz Yisrael, and most of us do not feel that it's applicable to Eretz Yisrael for various different reasons, but it certainly is applicable to Chutz Laaretz, where we are, and but people see that the Orthodox Jews make a great simcha over the release of somebody that they do not understand the miscarriage of justice involved. As far as they're concerned, he is a convicted criminal based on the American system. They tend to find this very strange, and they tend to see this as celebrating criminals, which is certainly not the impression we want to leave with them. And again, I think that Yizgaros Fumos, it's bucking the system. It comes across as if we don't respect the system of law in America, which is a very big show, Hashem.
Okay. Do you have any other concerns?
Yes. The other concern is a more general one for the moment, which is that there is a basic understanding, I think, which I've come across in many of my students, that the anti-Semitism which exists in the world is inherent in the non-Jewish personality, and that it comes from Halacha B'Yodua Esav Sein El Yaakov. And I feel that this is very a misconception of Esav Sein El Yaakov. First of all, we don't find, I believe, till the Abarbanel, anybody who understood that this applies to anybody other than Yaakov and Esav themselves. There's even a question of whether the word halacha is a tos at foot, it should be ha b'yodua, and the application of it to all non-Jews, and to say that any Yehudi has an antipathy and for a Yehudi is something which is very wrong and underlies a lot of, I think, the inappropriate attitude towards the secular authorities and, in general, other people and other cultures. I want to add something, if I may, which is that many years ago, I wanted to publish in a certain periodical, this is a third concern. I don't want to name it, a letter about racism in the Orthodox community, which was and probably is still a problem. This went to the editorial board, and they were back and forth, is this a good idea, not a good idea? And one of the members of the editorial board called me, and he said, he's not going to publish the letter. And he said, why? He says, because he doesn't believe that we should publish letters or any articles about issues which are washing, so to speak, our dirty laundry in public, if they're not going to be a toelis, if they're not going to be advantageous or correct the situation. And then he went further. And he said that's why he doesn't allow this periodical to publish articles about Choshen Mishpat, about monetary matters and dealing dishonestly with the authorities, with the government, and so on and so forth. He says even though he certainly does not condone such behavior and such activity, nevertheless, he understands where it's coming from, the approach in Europe before the war, as a result of the war, and he doesn't think it's going to change, and therefore it's not worth writing about and bringing it up in public. So I think it's important for us to, on the contrary, understand that and discuss that the nature and notion of anti-Semitism, especially in what we call in the Dino Shel Chesed, and not to have this assumption that everybody is out to get us, because it actually breeds bad midos and also a certain hisnatzchus, a certain sense of victory when we, so to speak, overcome the other side.
So, Rabbi Bechafa, let me share with you that there's something not accepted, but it's Yerushalmi. It's in Perek Tes of the Durim. I don't remember what halacha it is. Maybe halacha Vav or Zayin. So the Yerushalmi says that there's a machlokes, Rabbi Akiva, and I think it's Ben Zayba. The Yerushalmi says, Rabbi Akiva says, Zeklal gadol the Torah of Ahaftal Areacha Kabaycha.
Right. Ben Azai.
The Gemara says, so Ben Azai says, Yeshwi klal gadol mizeh. What?
Right.
So what does the Pnei Baisha say on the spot? He says, because the end of the pasuk is Kibitzela Malikib Ases Adam. So he says, Rabbi Akiva is saying, V'hafta L'Reyecha Kabaycha. You have to love Reyecha, right? And
right.
Ben Azai is saying, no, Bitzela Malikim Ases Adam, which goes on to Ben Noyech too, is also, he says, Bitzela Malikib Ases Adam, but every Ben Noyech is Bitzela Malikib. So Yeshli Gavol Mizeh, he's saying that there's a din of Ahava, even to a guy, certainly a respect, that he's a tzela malikim. And this is a Gemara that is not oft quoted among the people I know.
Right. It's not where, it's rarely quoted, you said?
Rarely quoted.
You're 100%, and I want to add a couple of things to what you said. First of all, another Yerushalmi with which I'm sure you're familiar. Yerushalmi happens to be Chaviv on me. I don't know if your listeners are aware that I have the entire Yerushalmi Shurim, 750 Shurim online for free download. Anybody wants to learn Yerushalmi? People have done it with me. So Yerushalmi in Bamitzia about Rabbi Shimon ben Shetach. Rabbi Shimon
right.
ben Shetach, you tell me him. As I said, I'm sure you're familiar with it, his Talmidim brought him a donkey, and in the donkeys, so that he would be able to make a living from that, and in the donkey's backpack, there was a precious stone, and the Talmidim said, look, you won't have to work anymore for the rest of your life, and the Shimon Shetach said, did the guy who sold it to you know that it was there? He said, no, he doesn't know, but whatever, there are heterium for such things. So, right, the turkey said, you think I'm a barbarian? Barbarian? No. I would give all kesef azad shavoylam, like you said, that we should say baruch location of mencheta. And this really is supposed to be our goal and our mission in this world. And if we're doing something which can cause a misunderstanding that not baruch location and mencheta, then we're going against our entire purpose and mission. Why? We're here in this world. I want to add something else quickly, which is that, I have a personal hero, we have Avraham Elliott Kaplan, that's out, the Beit Kvos HaYira. He has an article of a mimer in his Sefer on the Sefer to put out on Shas, on the Getter of an Enoch, and he says, makes the point which was said before about loving Kol Adam Basher Hu Adam, and he says that much of the halachas which we find in, and the attitude which we find in Chazal, was specifically towards Umot of the Avodah Zarah. It does not refer to Noitrim and Muslimim. It doesn't refer to them because they have halacha of Bnei Noach. And since they have halacha of Bnei Noach, therefore these things do not apply to them. He says maybe even they have a status of Ger Toshav, which of course not knowing was one of them.
This is the Meiri. This is the sheet of the Meiri in many places. Yeah.
Right. It's in Meir and Baba Kaaba Daf Lamed Ches. Right. Yes.
Yeah. It's not in the Skabal. I mean, the halacha to me, I haven't seen anybody who ever uses the Meiri halacha, but it's a nice sheet.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, but I don't know.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I'm not sure whether we're talking about halacha, strict letter of the law here, we're talking about listening to Shura Sadin. I think we're talking about what the Mitzvah Shurim says, called Kobas or Adam Bolamo, which goes beyond the strict letter of the law.
And Rabbi Bechafa, and you believe that teaching an attitude of disrespect towards the Bnei Noach leads to bad things. That's what you believe.
Absolutely. Correct, yes.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Rabbi Ben-Hafa, for joining us.
A pleasure. Thank you very much.
We have on the phone with us from New York, Rabbi Yaakov Horowitz, who's the founder of Yeshiva Darkei Noam. He's also the founder of Project Yes, the Chaver of Medi Sfarim. Welcome, Rabbi Horowitz.
Hi, David. Always a pleasure.
Rabbi Horowitz, as a mechanech par excellence, how do you explain to children what is going on right now in our community in Shalom Aruch Rebashkin?
Well, I think there are a number of I think there are a number of beautiful things about this whole, you know, incident with from the time of his, you know, original arrest throughout the sentencing and then the campaign, you know, to try to release him early. I mean, full disclosure, my dear friend and Chutin, Gary Apfel of Los Angeles, devoted years of his life, literally, pro bono, money out of his pocket. I've rarely seen such devotion, day and night, to help secure his release. And I'm very proud of his efforts, and I think it's really beautiful. I mean, so the nice things are the fact that so many people care, that so many people around the world really felt a sort of a personal connection to this. I'm not an attorney, and I did not follow the case closely enough to really make an informed opinion, but I think it's pretty it's pretty clear that the sentence was the time of the sentence, you know, the amount, whatever, 27 years or so, was extremely excessive. There were a lot of problems brought up in the case. I mean, the fact that 100 people, elected officials from both parties, signed the commutation request really tells you that they really felt an injustice was done. It doesn't just say, you know, release him. It says release him because of, and everybody signed their name to that. So I think the fact that a husband is home with his wife and father is home to their children is something to be happy for, very happy for. And I think it's beautiful, the level of connection, the fact that so many people were praying and davening for him and really emotionally involved in it. You know, I was unsettled by the public celebrations. I felt it was inappropriate to in this age of you know, 24-hour media and one smartphone gets everything online. I just didn't think it was wise. And I do have a public voice on social media. I did call people who are very high up in Askanas in public life, representing our community before the government. And they were very unsettled by it as well. I'm talking top people. I asked people who were involved in this case and who regularly interact with government officials, regardless of how we feel about it. You know, he in the public eye, he's a convicted felon. And I just felt that those public celebrations were really were not what our community needs.
Okay, and as far as, you know, him going to schools and giving out candy, et cetera, what's your feeling about that?
Well, I was, you know, I stepped down from my yeshiva a few years ago. So I was not, you know, I'm not directly interacting with children on that level now, but when he was sent to prison and children did ask me about it and, you know, do making mishaveiros for him. So, you know, I did say in every conversation that I had with the children, I did say that that he committed crimes and, you know, to put at least some context in the conversation, which I think is important. He's not Rav Shimon Bar Yochai coming out of a cave where I spent 12 years learning, I don't think that he should be glorified as a hero. I think it's beautiful that thousands of people felt connected enough to celebrate for him. I really think that's beautiful. I think there needs to be some context here, and I think in some of the written reports, it really, I don't think it was presented fully that way, that here's a man who's made mistakes and did things wrong, and, you know, the punishment was over the top, and we're delighted to have him home. I must tell you that, you know, for my Gary, he, you know, most people our age, David, and, you know, don't impress that easily. And he was extraordinarily impressed with his faith, with you know, Shom Brubaskin, his faith, with the grace in which he took everything. He certainly has a lot of great qualities to him, but I think it needs to be put in context.
You think this is not the Alter Rebbe coming out of jail, or the Tana who went to jail because he had tefillin in his hand, or Rebbe Kiva was teaching Torah during Zeres?
Right. That's what I meant about Rav Shimon bar Yochai coming out of the cave. You know, that's what I meant. I mean, you know, and especially in Chabad, for example, where the many years, the majority, you know, a great deal of the time of the Hasidus existed, they were either on the communist rule, and before that under a very anti-Semitic regime, and there were celebrations, you know, people going into prison. Tzaddikim, you know, the Rebbe, the Baal Tanya, and a great celebration upon his release. I am concerned about that message, the message that celebrating someone's release, even early release from prison, you know, can convey to children that the system is rigged against us as Orthodox Jews, and therefore we're not going to get a fair shake, and therefore the rules, you know, it weakens the faith that we, that as a country we should, our children should be having in the rule of law. And I mean, to be perfectly honest, I've been very outspoken that President Trump has been weakening the respect for the rule of law. Every time he tweets about it, I mean, I'm consistent in my thinking. I think it's just beyond horrible that the leader of our country is, you know, demonstrating a lack of faith and publicly talking about lack of faith in his own Justice Department. So all of these things.
The purpose of Dinim, you're saying that the purpose of Dinim, like, Rishonim says that without it, Ishus Riyayu Chayim Balai.
Chayim Balai, right.
And rules are important to have a functioning society.
Right. Traffic lights are important. Traffic lights are important. Right. And there's a lot of research. There's a lot of research in the general population about, you know, when people have a code of practice or a set of rules themselves, you know, it's often, and then you introduce another set of rules. It's all in the minds of people, you know, which set of rules govern. And in our situation, because, you know, our beautiful yeshiva system on the Saiva tends to have paramount respect for the rule of the Torah, the halacha, what we call halacha, in this great country where it's, I mean, pretty clear that it's the best we've ever had it in 2,000 years, and people do have the ability to go into any profession they want and to feel safe and practice religion as we wish to, we should be teaching our children a sense of civic pride and a sense of pride in our government and respect for the rule of law. And when it's presented in a one-sided way like this, like these bad people wanted to lock this man up forever, and now we're celebrating, again, the statement should be made that in this case, it was excessive. You know, this bleeds over to other areas like for example, the whole issue of child safety and reporting to the authorities. And if you tend to believe that the system is rigged and you can't get a fair shake and an Orthodox Jew can't, which I don't believe to be true, but if this message is conveyed in many different ways, it undermines what's just a fundamentally important concept of the rule of law.
Rabbi Horowitz, thank you very much for your time.
Always a pleasure, David, anytime.
Okay, bye-bye.
We have the honor of having with us on the phone Gary Apfel, who is an attorney based in Los Angeles. He works for a very prestigious firm, Pepper Hamilton, and he has for the last 4.5 years been working pro bono for Shlomo Rabashkin, and gave that very poignant and moving speech that I think most of us saw about how he heard that Rabashkin was going to be freed. Welcome, I'm Gary.
Thank you very much, David. It's a great pleasure to be speaking to you.
So as a matter of background, did you grow up in New York or L.A.? Where did you go to yeshiva? I mean, did you just to give us a little bit of a perspective?
Sure. I grew up on the west side of Manhattan. My father, Oliver Shalom, was born in Vienna and moved to America during World War II. And my mother, Yubala Lachaim, was born in Berlin, also moved during World War II. And we grew up on the west side. And then, and as I'm so proud to say, my father and my grandfather and my great-grandfather were close with Kapitchinitz from Vienna. And Baruch Hashem, I'm thrilled that my children are now fifth generation that are close with Kapitchinitz, which is a major, the major influence in my life are my father and the Kapitchinitz Rebbes. And about 35 years ago, I moved to California when my wife, who was from California, said she'd like to move back to L.A.
So just as a matter of the Kapitchinitz Rebbe was my Sandek.
No. Oh, I don't believe
yes.
it.
Yes. And I'll tell you something else. My father's Sandek as well. And I think my father said, I'm the only person he knows who the Kapitchinitz Rebbe was, a father and a son, both his Sandek.
Unbelievable. He was my Sandek too, and he put my tefillin on my bar mitzvah. You know, that's amazing. David, I hope that I'll get the chance to meet you in person because I love meeting people who became Jews in the hands of the Kapitchinitz Rebbe.
Well, there you go.
Wow.
So Gary, we had two Rabbanim who we interviewed who both expressed the following concern, or they each actually expressed different concerns. But one of them expressed a concern. He said, In our community, I shouldn't say our, but in a lot of from a community, there's a suspicion of the greater, you know, law system as a whole. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that in Europe, you know, we were targets. There was state-sponsored anti-Semitism. And in Poland, there were 160 different jobs that a Jew was not allowed to do, include things like owning land, et cetera. This is as of law, judicially not allowed to do. So there's a lot of suspicion, and Jews had to do things like smuggling. I mean, there was no other way for them to earn a livelihood. There was a state sponsored effort to drive them beyond into poverty, but actually into like hunger. And there's a residual of that. So when we have somebody who is arrested. And yes, there was a sentence that was all agree was, you know, most of the people I speak to say was a breakdown of the justicism, or maybe Linda Reed may be a closet anti-Semite, et cetera, et cetera. But the man is a convicted felon, and now we're dancing and making mesibis and having, and we're basically reinforcing to our children, the goyim are out to get us, the judicial system isn't honest. With the blowover being is, if they're out to get us, then we don't have to treat them so well. We can roll back the odometers. I know there's a shul near where I live where half the shul is in and out of jail at any time because the Rebbe in this shul speaks to Gayim, they're out to get us, they're the Sinim, the Esav, Sinim, the Yankee. And when you just listen to this and listen to this and listen to this means I can cheat you. I could steal from you. So this, Rav was saying, it's reinforcing this in our community that, okay, yes, there was an anti-Semitic thing, but all the jubilation and the victory laps is reinforcing this. This is what one of the Rabbanim we had on, and I'm curious if you could respond to that.
That's a very long question. You made a lot of different points in that question, and if I'm permitted, I'd like to try to give you an appropriate, responsive, long answer and try to address all the things that you mentioned in the question, if that's okay.
Sure. You have the microphone.
First of all, I must say, first of all, that when you were mentioning about Poland and the restrictions, et cetera, unfortunately, there are restrictions like that in the United States as well. I live in Hancock Park in California, and I will show you the deed to my house. And the deed to my house says, no Negroes, no Mexicans, and no Jews may live in this house except in the servants' quarters. So unfortunately, it exists in the United States as well. America is a land of laws, but unfortunately, at times, the laws are only as good as the people that apply them. What gives us hope is this case, because so many non-Jewish senior, former, prominent members of the judicial system, including every living former attorney general prior to the Obama administration, multiple deputy attorneys general, federal judges, state judges, U.S. attorneys, all the outpouring and the outcry that they all had in this case should solidify the fact that even though, yes, there are people, Esav son of Yaakov, and there are people out there that still are anti-Semites today, unfortunately, that's a fact, but this country is run and administered by people who aren't that way. Certainly nothing that may have happened or happens against Jews ever justifies a Jew breaking the law. And I'm not a Rav, so I'm not going to say Dina de Malchusa Dina. It's just not the proper thing to do. We're Yidden. We have to set an example for the world. That's why we're here. And first and foremost, it starts with obeying the laws and behaving like proper citizens with good midos in every way, including obviously obeying the law. So that's certainly not, in my opinion, I don't know who this Rav was that you were mentioning, but that's not appropriate or justified. In terms of the celebrations, let me start by saying this. As Shalom Mordechai Rabashkin's attorney, who I think it's fair to say is intensively familiar with all the details of this case, I share Alan Dershowitz's view that had Shalom gotten a fair trial, he would have been acquitted. So I think in part the celebrations are the fact that a man that was wrongfully convicted, because you said he's a convicted felon. Well, yes, that's true that technically in the Northern District of Iowa, based on the tactics, the egregious misconduct tactics that were engaged in by these prosecutors, and that's not my words, that's the words that were in a letter signed by 107 former senior Justice Department officials to the then U.S. attorney in Northern District of Iowa, which was reinforced in a meeting that I had the privilege of attending with three former deputy attorneys general who were outraged by the conduct of these prosecutors. So, yes, he was a convicted felon, but he was convicted in a situation where he did not receive a fair trial and where his constitutional rights were trampled upon.
Gary, wouldn't you agree, Gary, that, I mean, the fact that the books were monkeyed with, et cetera, and I'm not going to wear a high hat and say, you know, everybody keeps 100% honest books and crosses every T, but, you know, there's nothing, you know, those are facts. I mean, you may say, well, for doing that, he should have gotten 2 years, but, you know, tampering with books and creating fake invoices, inflating them. I read the letters that you're referring to on the White House, that Gov site that was signed by all those attorney generals, and in the letter they write, he tampered with financial statements, right? And I think it is somewhat humorously, and he paid some beef vendors 11 days late. I think that was the exact, was somewhat the maybe paraphrasing. And for that, he got a sentence greater than, you know, they list a whole bunch, Skilling, et cetera, people who ran off with, you know, tens of billions of dollars. But even in their letter, they say he did tamper with financial statements. So when you say that Dershowitz says that in a fair trial he would have gotten off, I mean, that's a fact.
No, it's not actually. I'm sorry, I don't want to disagree with you. I certainly never like to disagree with anyone for whom the Kapitshyn Sereba was his sandig, but it's not a fact. The letters that you read are not the letters that I was referring to. The letters that you read were crafted to the President of the United States in order to maximize the ability to obtain a commutation.
The argument that this Rav is making is, he says you have somebody who was a felon who inflated invoices, many invoices, right, for millions of dollars, and yes, he could have paid it back, but he did inflate them, and he should have gotten 2 years and not 27 years. We could agree on that.
In order to be liable under criminal laws, you have to have criminal intent. Yes, he did authorize inflated receivables certifications and inflated inventory certifications, but he did so at the request of the bank, because the bank said to him, rather than come in for a waiver, since, and I'll explain to you in a simple way what the issue was, they were allowed to borrow up to 55% of inventory and 60% of receivables. So for every $100 of receivables that they had, they could borrow $60. So, and what they were doing constantly was going in and getting waivers and amending the documents. There were times when the banker said to him, you know what, Shalom, I know you only have $100 of inventory. I know you need $70 now, not $60. Say that you have 110. Don't worry about it. We'll still be fully collateralized, and we'll fix this later. Now,
can I ask you a question, Gary? You're an attorney. Gary, can I ask you a question? Could you imagine if every time there's a fraud committed, the guy says the bank asked me to commit the fraud? I mean, what would happen to our legal system if this argument flew? I didn't do it. The bank told me to. You lied on your mortgage application. The bank told me to lie on my mortgage application. There was no intent.
Yeah, You know what, David?
Yeah.
You know what, David? You know what? Did you ever hear the subprime mortgage crisis? I represented. Yeah, sure. I was hired by the Federal Reserve Board and the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency to do a foreclosure look-back review. To do a foreclosure look-back review for two of the 14 major mortgage servicers. In fact, when I met Rosa Hinda Weiss the first time, I was commuting to Philadelphia because one of these large mortgage servicers, then was called Ally Bank, but originally was GMAC Mortgage, was based outside of Philadelphia, and I was commuting there weekly. And guess what? That's exactly what happened in thousands and thousands of cases. The bankers were telling the customers, inflate your income statement, inflate the value of your house, we'll be able to lend you more money. Now, whether you like it or not, that's just a fact. And you can't say how would it look
so we can,
in every single
Gary,
case.
In effect,
these
we
are,
can never,
these are facts.
Gary, we can never, in effect, in the United States, prosecute anybody for fraud again, because the argument is always the bank told me to do it, the vendor told me to do it. I'm just following orders. The other guy told me to inflate my statements, to lie in my thing. I mean, that's in effect the argument you're saying.
David, that's a silly statement. Sorry, forgive me, but that's silly. We can never again. The man can say it, but there has to be evidence to that effect. You know.
So was there evidence that the bank asked him to inflate the statements?
You know what? This is something that I can't get into under attorney-client privilege. But suffice it to say that I, as his attorney, am representing to you that had he had a fair trial and had all the facts come out of trial, he would have been acquitted. Okay? So that's number one. Number two, and by the way, number two, Haraya, as we say in the yeshiva, Haraya, he was indicted on over 9,000 counts of state labor law violations in a state trial after he was convicted in the federal trial. And there he got a fair trial. That was a trial by jury with a fair judge. And guess what happened? 9,000 counts. He was acquitted of all 9,000 counts. Now you may say, wait a minute, somebody gets indicted on 9,000 counts. It's not possible. They didn't do something wrong. It's not possible. Why would prosecutors bring 9,000 counts? And yet 9,000 counts, and he was acquitted on all of them. And to me, if you want evidence why I say that had he had a fair trial in the federal case, he would have been acquitted, the state case serves as very powerful evidence of that.
So you're saying that when this Rav says is that it's sending a bad message to our children, that somebody who was convicted and in effect was saying the system was out to get us, and this supports that idea that there's a crooked system, it's against the Jews, we're making big celebrations, you know, we defeated Haman. You don't think that's sending a bad signal?
You know, something,
point was.
You are mischaracterizing what's happening here, or this Rav is, and you're just repeating it. What we're celebrating here is that someone was improperly convicted of a crime, was given a sentence that was way out of proportion to even the crime that he was convicted of. And lo and behold, later, the loss that was the foundation for the 27 years, the evidence was it was the prosecutors that caused it. And ultimately, the system worked because the bad people, the prosecutors who engaged in the misconduct got caught with what they did. And ultimately, the system worked and the man was freed. And of course we should be celebrating that. Of course we should be.
But
to condemn the entire American judicial system because of some prosecutors in Iowa who engaged in this conduct, that's a mischaracterization.
In your speech, you said this is a big nest that happened. We got a pardon. I don't think anybody sees this, that the judicial system worked.
The whole system works. Our system of checks and balances work because ultimately, frankly, I think it's just a lack of sophistication when people make that statement, because our system of checks and balances that were established by the founders of the Constitution, no one branch has complete ultimate authority. So you have the judiciary, but there's a check on that. And the check on that is that the President of the United States can determine that the judiciary did not act properly and can grant clemency. You have the judiciary that can say that the President of the United States, when he's restricting immigration into the United States, has gone beyond his authority. And you have the legislature that can impeach the President of the United States and can impeach judges. So we have a system of checks and balances. And guess what? It worked because, as you know—
Gary, it wasn't an S, it was just the judicial system worked.
Yeah. You know, David, I can't wait to meet you in person, and I hope, notwithstanding this lively dialogue, you'll still want to meet with me. But absolutely.
I'm just pointing out that I don't think anybody thinks that this was
David, this is the second time you've taken what he's done in a year because the entire
Jewish world pressured him. This is not the judicial system working.
David, there are two concepts, and what you just said seems to, as if the one concept doesn't exist for you. Ein Simchan al Hanes, which means that when you have a situation, you have to do your hishtaglos, you have to work through the system, you have to do things that are derech hateva, but at the same time, chayavin lahakir v'nes.
Yeah. So let me tell you another point. So another Rav we had on made the following point. He said, you know, these dancings and all the celebrations, they made it onto, let's say, Google front page, which is, I actually saw it there, and was picked up nationally. And when the Goyim see this, you know, they don't dig into the minutia. It's a bunch of bearded people jumping up and down and saying, you know, this guy, we had some guy who was convicted. He was supposed to be for 27 years. He got out after 8 years, and you know, the president, you know, has an Orthodox son-in-law, and he commuted, and there were a number of articles, and you start reading the comments of these articles, and many of them are hair-raising, like from the Washington Post had 527 comments. I actually thumbed through them, some of the comments. Here's a man who the agriculture department in Iowa, said, had the most egregious human rights violations he has ever seen. One bathroom for every 150 workers. There were many, many comments like this. And the guy said, what happened to the recognition of the Gemara in Ksubis? It says, remember that you're in Gullus. You're not supposed to rate on the Umay Salem. You're not supposed to incite them. When you know, can you think of another commutation of some guy who was in jail? You have many, you know, African-Americans who've done the three strikes and you're out. Obama, one guy, the last thing he stole was a cheeseburger and he got a life sentence because it was the third strike. He said there was no partying then and this. It was understood. Okay, you got lucky. There was so this person is, have we lost our entire sensitivity to the fact that we are guests here? This creates could create tremendous anti-Semitism. And if you don't believe it does, read the comments on the newspapers that picked up the dancing.
I know you're a sophisticated person. I know you're sophisticated enough to know that everything you read in the Washington Post has nothing to do with Sheldon Rubashkin. It's anything that they can do to bash Trump. And that when you have 500 comments, that most of those comments, as a matter of fact, are generated by one or two people, and it's not 500 people that are doing it, because I've been following the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the Des Moines Register, which 8 years ago was writing stories about Sheldon Markla as if he was the worst person in the world, and they wrote beautiful articles about the celebration and how what a wonderful day this is, which followed an editorial by the Des Moines Register's editorial board that these prosecutors need to be investigated for what they did. And second of all, I mean, you know, there were so many things that you said here, it's so difficult to respond to all of them, to remember even all the things that you said. But the celebration here, and Larry Thompson, Louis Free, Judge Charles Renfrew, John Ashcroft, Edwin Meese, and Ramsey Clark, and if any of your listeners don't know who these people are, go look them up. None of them are Jewish, and every single one of them said to me, this is the most egregious case of misconduct that they've seen in their entire career. And that's what the celebration is. And he could be white, black, yellow, green, blue, or gold. That's what the celebration is. The celebration is that there was an egregious case of misconduct here, and the President of the United States had the courage to stand up to that misconduct and to provide clemency. It has nothing to do with the fact that he's Jewish. Now, of course, in the Jewish community, we're celebrating because he's one of ours, which is beautiful. But this celebration would be the same no matter what color he is by all the people in the legal establishment who aren't Jewish. And you know something? You're right that we have to behave ourselves. But that doesn't mean that if a non-Jew looks at me and says that I've done something wrong, when I've done nothing wrong, I have to apologize for it.
Let's move this forward. So now you have people dancing, and they're saying, we have somebody who the commutation letter that was signed by these 100 people says he committed multiple felonies and he was released early because it was the sentence was too strict, and now there's big celebrating. Do you see that a guy could look at this, or somebody, an outsider could look and scratch their head and say, that's inappropriate behavior for somebody who committed multiple felonies to be having a victory lap and to having celebrations? Do you think that that's
David, an unfair thing for somebody to view?
And is that comparable? Let me just finish. And is that comparable to what you were talking about, anti-Semitism, when somebody says, I don't want Jews in my neighborhood? Would you say that somebody who takes this position is the equivalent of saying, I don't want Jews in my neighborhood, saying, hey, why are they doing big celebrating when somebody who committed multiple felonies gets out of jail early?
David, you're mischaracterizing. And in fact, you did this to me before. Are you sure you're not a lawyer? Because the way you speak, you sound like
I'm a lawyer. Every yeshiva boy.
Okay.
Is a lawyer. What do you
All right. Because you repeated one of the big lies before, and I didn't catch you on it because you kept going. You didn't give me a chance to respond. You said there were multiple amputations in a short period of time. That is a lie. There were no amputations. The only time there was someone lost a few fingers was when he turned off the safety. He himself apologized, the man who did this. That was one of the big lies that PETA did. And in fact, agriprocessors received a bonus back from the insurance company because there were so few accidents. That's the truth. Now, you want to say the lie that there were multiple violations and terrible working conditions and all those things, the big lies that these horrible prosecutors who wanted just to paint a terrible picture of this man perpetrated, then you can repeat it. I can't stop you from repeating it.
But David, as someone who has studied
this case carefully and lived through for the last 4.5 years, those are lies. And you're repeating lies that people are doing to try to wrongfully paint a picture, as his trial lawyer, Guy Cook, said to me. Guy Cook, who's not Jewish, never knew this man before, said, Gary, Shalom Rabashkin is a saint. I've seen him. I know him. He's a saint. And what these prosecutors did is they took a saint and they made a black bearded monster out of him. And David, you're repeating what they did.
Let me ask you a question. Let's say a guy committed no felonies and a jury wrongfully convicted him of 20 felonies, right? And then he goes to jail and then the sentence is commuted because it's too long. And then he gets released out of jail and there's wild celebrations. So it says, this man was convicted of X felonies and now there's a huge party. So I'm reading this and I'm saying, well, the justice system for the most part is usually correct. It says he was convicted. Okay, it was too long. Wow. But now they're making huge parties? Sort of, is your average person going to say, well, maybe the conviction was wrong. Maybe he's like some guy in Murderers Row. They found the DNA. People don't think about that. The takeaway is that Jews are celebrating because they figured out a way to sort of.
No, David, you're mischaracterizing. You're mischaracterizing. You're playing right into the hands of these prosecutors. The celebration here is a simple celebration. This was a case, according to five former living attorney generals, of the most egregious prosecutorial misconduct that they ever saw in their entire career. These are men who combined have 200 years of experience in the American judicial system. And the celebration is that this egregious misconduct, because of the compassion and the correctness of the President of the United States, was ended and the man is released from prison. And we're celebrating the fact that this egregious misconduct was finally corrected and ended. That's the celebration. And all these things that you're saying, I don't know why you're saying it, but they're distractions. They're playing up to PETA. They're playing up to the prosecutors. They're playing up to the enemies of President Trump. That's what these things are. I'm sorry, you hear the passion in my voice, but it just grates on me when anybody says this. This is terrible. This is terrible. This man, according to his non-Jewish lawyer, is a saint. And these prosecutors made him into a black bearded monster, a black bearded monster. And what you're doing is you're repeating the rishus that they did. David, that's not right. That's not right. And any Jew that does that, I know you're just repeating what the others have said. I don't know. I don't know. They weren't brought up right. What can I tell you?
You're saying again, if a guy looks at it and it says he was convicted of bank fraud and sentenced to 27 years, and he served more than 8 years of the sentence, which many have called excessive. That's what it says. It says it's not a presidential pardon. It does not vacate his conviction. It leaves in place a term of supervised release and substantial restitution obligation, which were all part of Mr. Rabashkin's sentence. Let's change this. His name isn't Mr. Rabashkin. His name is Leroy Jackson. And now the Jews would see 10,000 African Americans or 100,000 celebrating, making sing. What would the reaction be?
If Leroy Jackson had been the victim of the most egregious misconduct in the history of the United States, and that's what people have said, this is the most egregious misconduct. This case will go down in the history books the way the Dreyfus case went down in France. That's what this case was. You know, when people were celebrating, when Medgar Evers was walked into the University of Mississippi or Alabama, I think it was Alabama, with George Wallace standing at the door, not letting him in. And when the federal government, the good federal government back in the 60s, was protecting his civil rights, and Jewish boys, not just black boys, but Jewish boys were going down there and fighting for them, and people were celebrating, the Jews were saying, thank God. And that's exactly what they'd be saying here if this was a Jew.
What an incredible journey you've had. 4.5 years of pro bono to fix a wrong, a perceived wrong. Quite an amazing story. We're going to go on to our next guest now, who's going to be speaking again about Birchas HaGaimel. We have on the phone with us from Chicago, Rabbi Yisrael Langer, who's a Paisik in the Beis Hayro of Chicago. He's also a rabbinic coordinator for the Chicago Rabbinical Council. Welcome, Rabbi Yisrael.
Shalom Aleichem.
So, Rabbi Yisrael, does a woman bench Gaimel?
Mishbura brings that the minute today that women do not bench Gaimel. It's because called Kavoda Bas Pelech Pnima, and since Gaimel has to be done in front of 10 men, so the minig that women do not bench goyim. Lo and minig Yushalayim, as Shlomo Zalman Orbach says, is that if the woman is around, let's say around family members after she had a, after having a child, and it's just close family members, and there are 10 men around, so she would bench goyim.
What about a child? Does a 10-year-old bench goyim?
So again, that's also a shayla in the Paiskim Halacha. We say that a child should not bench goyimel, because the nusach of the bracha is hagoyimel lechayovim toivais, lechayovim, somebody who is chayiv, and a katan is not somebody who is chayiv, it's not somebody who's held accountable for what they do, and so therefore they don't make the bracha hagoyimel lechayovim toivais.
There are other opinions.
There are other opinions. Yes, yeah, there are other opinions. But the minig is that children, we never find the cotton getting up by the bima and benching gaimel. That's the minig. The minig oilam is that that ketanim do not bench gaimel.
No, but Langer, if somebody had a something happened to them on Monday, and it's 3 days before Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, it's 4 days before Thursday. Do they wait till Thursday, or should they make it in shul not by laning?
So again, appeal Achim Mishavur says that to do it within 3 days. So if something happened on Monday, technically to wait till Thursday would be ready after 3 days. So it would seem that ideally one should try to do it l'chatchila within 3 days. But here again, the minig olam seems to be to also to wait till the day of Kriyas HaTorah, and then they'll wait till Thursday, and when they get at Kriyas HaTorah, they'll go ahead and they'll bench gremel then.
Rabbi Langer, what if somebody was in a car accident, somebody was a disease, was sick? Give us some type of a parameters of what rises to the level of goyimel and what doesn't.
Okay, so to bench goyimel, if somebody was almost in a sakana, that's not going to allow them to bench goyimel. One should not bench goyimel in such a situation. If one was in a car accident where they got, Rishon Lezalman brings, if one got knocked hard, he was in the car accident and he got knocked. It was a kind of a knock which could potentially be fatal. So in that kind of a situation, one would bench goyimel. But if one was in a near car accident where they slammed on their brakes and they didn't hit into another car, or even if their car might have gotten hit, but they weren't knocked around at all in the car. So that was almost in a sakana. They weren't in a sakana, and then one would not bench goyimel in such a situation.
If somebody leaves jail where they're in jail for something that is merely monetary matters and therefore there is no danger to their lives, as opposed to where they're in jail for something that was, they did something that could be a life, a punishment with some type of a life-threatening punishment, what's the halacha? Does it have to be a capital event, or could even be for money? When do you bench Geimel?
If there's a capital event, an event where it could have been a capital punishment, so that's clear in halacha that one would bench goyimel. The Magid Avraham says that one should not bench goyimel if there is no sakana involved. It's not an event which would had any risk of getting the death penalty of any sort, so one should not bench goyimel. Certainly, that's by monetary situations, one according to that would not bench goyimel. If a person did a crime or was put into a prison cell with other high criminals that do the hardcore criminals, Zir Paiskin do say that that's also a sakana to be put in that kind of a cell together with in prison together with those kind of criminals. That itself could be a sakana and would be reason to bench goyimel. But if a small crime, something done monetarily, those kinds of prisons are usually not a sakana. And when in those kinds of situations, one would not bench goyimel because of the safek brachas l'hakol. Rishon Lezalman does say that it's kedai when you're making the bracha in shachris, when you say at the end of the bracha, you say and using that when saying that bracha, one should have in mind anytime there's a suffix, a shaila comes up regarding benching goyimel, the suffix, so it's kedai you're saying the bracha anyway, baruch ata Hashem, goyimel chasadim toivim l'ama Yisrael, one should have in mind to cover that benching goyim. They could do it in earshot where 10 people could hear, and that would even be better.
What about people who share the simcha of the person who was saved? So the Shulchan Aruch brings that another person could also make a bracha. Have you ever seen anybody do that? What is our minig b'zman hazeh?
Okay, I was wondering about that. I have never seen that done. I've never seen it done. So I don't know. I just haven't seen it done.
It's like a Birchas Haroya by Goybel.
Right.
Okay, are there any other chidushim in the parsha, or any other areas that you think maybe the Olam is not aware of that you'd like to share with us?
There's an interesting psak for Moshe Feinstein. Moshe was known that he held that any time a person flies on an airplane, even Bizman Azeh, where airplanes really aren't a sakana, but he held that a person flies on an airplane, one should bench goymul. So Rav Moshe, once he came for Shabbos to Memphis, and everybody was waiting. He gave Rav Moshe a shlishi, they gave him an aliyah, and everybody was waiting for Rav Moshe, the Marid Shmaisa, to go ahead and to bench goymul, and he didn't bench goymul.
Okay.
So they after davening, they went over to him, Ephraim Greenblatt, Zichron Baruch Hu, went over to him and asked him how come he didn't bench goymul, and he explained that he only bench goymul at the end of the trip. So meaning that when he was traveling to Memphis, that's one stop on the way, then he's going to be returning back. So in that situation, he only benches goymul on the return trip, once he gets back home. However, I heard from Reb Shmuel first, Shlita, that Reb Moshe held that if you go to Eretz Yisrael, that would be different. If you go to Eretz Yisrael, then one would bench goymul, even if he's returning back within a few days. And the reason is because Meher Yibon HaMikdash, and the hope is that we're going to stay in Eretz Yisrael, that it's going to end up being a prolonged stay in Eretz Yisrael, and it's not just going to be a short trip. The idea is that Eretz Yisrael, it's not just a stop along the way. Eretz Yisrael, it's a kvias to it, that you come to Eretz Yisrael, it's not just a stop along on your journey.
Well, I can't think of a better way to end our program than with Advar. Thank you very much for sharing that story with us.
Okay, yeah.
So in closing, what do we have? We have some interesting shilos about Berchas HaGoyimel. I personally do not make a bracha on flying by plane. I consider it, honestly, a bracha of Atollah, given where we are today. And on the Rabashkin discussion, I leave it up to my audience to listen and to cogitate about it on their own. And in closing, I got an interesting email last week. He said, David, last week you said that a person has to take their personal inventory, look into their mirror, and look for their milas. And he said, do you have any other makairis for this? You seem to think it's such an important thing. And I would like to say a fabulous makair, let me share with you. What is the most important mitzvah in the Torah? What is the biggest klal gadol of a Torah in mitzvahs? So the Gemara says, Amar Rabbi Akiva, Zeh klal gadol b'tayra, v'hafta l'reacha kamaycha. And what does the Gemara in Bava Metzia say? The Gemara says, all the other mitzvahs are a sniff l'tayra, right? V'idach zil gemar, zu ikre shel tayra, v'idach zil gemar. I'm the Gemara in Shabbos, when somebody came to the hill. So if this is the most important in the Torah, what does it say? V'hafta l'reacha, love your neighbor, which is basically all of Chayshu Mishpat, so much of the rest of the Shulchan Aruch. V'hafta l'reyecha kamaycha, like you love yourself. In other words, if you don't think you're worthy and you don't love yourself, you're not going to be able to be mekayim any mitzvahs. If you're mi anaychi, who am I, ben agarnished, how much are you going to accomplish in life? So the hakdama to all mitzvahs is kamaycha, to the klal gadol b'tayra. So look into your maris at tzivis, count your attributes, try to figure out your story. Each of us has to figure ma ze biyadcha, what are the powers that were given to us? What is our story? What is your story, your unique story? When we figure that out, we have the beginning of geula. This is David Lichtenstein for Headlines.